Hello, everybody, and welcome. I'm your host, Dr. Maish Seibel,
founder of My Menopause Magazine, in the Apple Newsstand and on Google Play.
And today, I have the distinct pleasure of talking about a topic, sex, with a person who is a world authority on it. We're talking today with Dr. Cheryl Kingsburg. Dr. Kingsburg is the chief of the Division of Behavioral Medicine at University Hospitals at Case Medical Center, and she's also a professor in the Department of Reproductive Biology and Psychiatry at Case Western Reserve University. So I want to say thank you very much for joining me today.
Well, thank you, Dr. Scheibel, for inviting me.
That's a pleasure. You know, I have to say, I have been hearing you lecture on this subject at every kind of meeting that you can imagine for years, and I've been reading your work for years. So it's really a distinct pleasure for me to have a chance to talk with you about a topic that you are certainly a leading authority on. So I wanted to talk about today setting the stage for understanding female sexual dysfunction. A lot of people think they're the only one that has this problem. It's very personal. It's embarrassing. It's awkward. But I don't think that that person is the only one, is she?
Oh, absolutely not. And I'm glad you started right off the bat. You know, when you said you've heard me for years, I can tell you some things have changed and some things haven't. And one of the things that hasn't changed is the high prevalence of sexual problems among women. Mm-hmm. And believe it or not, nearly 50% of U.S. women will report having a sexual complaint or a problem. When we think about when we think about what's a true sexual dysfunction or disorder, it's certainly not 50% of women, but honestly, it's close to 11%. So we're at, you know, nearly 1 in 10 women have a diagnosable sexual dysfunction.
So just to clarify, so at some point in their lifespan, about half of women are going to complain at some point that things are not going just right for them, that there's something awry in terms of their sexual function. But about 1 in 10 women actually has a diagnosable condition that constitutes the diagnosis of female sexual dysfunction.
That is absolutely correct. So for those women who are wondering, am I the only one, they are absolutely not the only one. Just to look around in a room full of 100 women and 10 of you are sitting there wondering, am I the only one?
Right. And it's always that way when you have an embarrassing topic, you know, when it's hard to talk about it, in the women's health arena, things like sexual function, things like loss of urine, things that are embarrassing often go undiscussed with the persons who can most help them, which is the healthcare providers, but they don't say anything.
No, it's true. And, you know, women are hoping that their physician or their healthcare provider will bring it up, and the healthcare provider is hoping it doesn't get brought up because oftentimes they're not trained to address these concerns. And so it's sort of this unspoken elephant in the room. But in reality, it is the healthcare provider's duty and responsibility to manage the sexual health of women. You know that the World Health Organization actually lists sexual health as a basic human right. So for women out there who are wondering, you know, should I bother my healthcare professional? Absolutely. And if you have a healthcare professional who's uncomfortable bringing it up, I have to say, find another one in your healthcare system.
Well, I think those are wise words. To get us started, though, in terms of, you know, the causes and things like that, maybe we could step back just a little bit, because we're going to come right front and center with what you're talking about. But just to give us some background, what are some of the things that can cause sexual dysfunction in women?
Well, first of all, sexual dysfunction is sort of an overarching term. It's one big word for many different sort of problems. So, And I think it's helpful to understand that, honestly, sexual concerns sort of happen in context, that we define what's normal at versus what's abnormal by our oftentimes by our culture. You know, if you think about it, 100 years ago, female sexuality was virtually ignored. Women were considered sort of promiscuous or nymphomaniacs if they actually liked being sexual. So, you know, we've come a long way from understanding that women's sexuality shouldn't be ignored. But
how could that have been good for the guys? I mean, how could that possibly? How would you want to be with someone who's, you know, who that seems like it's backwards, but. Anyway, the premise was women are not supposed to know about that stuff.
That is true. And they're certainly not supposed to enjoy it.
Right.
As soon as it was determined that orgasm for women was not necessary for conception, it became essentially demonized for women to enjoy sex. And so it's taken us, you know, another 100 years to sort of march our way back to understanding that women deserve healthy sexual function. So we've gotten there, but we still have many sexual problems. So, well, you said, what are the, you know, how do you define a sexual problem? We look at it in sexual medicine as essentially there are 6 different sexual problems. The first one, and the most prevalent, is what we call hypoactive sexual desire disorder, or in layman's terms, low sexual desire.
Mm-hmm.
Or the lack of interest in being sexual. So this is when there is persistent. I don't mean just that, you know, it's been a bad week or there's, a period of time after you have a baby, short period of time. I'm talking a persistent loss of interest where
you've lost your mojo.
Yes, you've lost your mojo and then some. That these women, miss wanting to want sex.
Mm-hmm.
And so for these women, it's a true disorder, and it's difficult because desire is one of those terms that we all sort of intuitively think we know the definition of because it's pretty easy to pronounce, but in fact, desire is kind of complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you think about it as having 3 parts to it. Drive, which is the biologic piece of desire, which is, spontaneous sexual interest. When your body signals through its sort of hunger to be sexual that it wants to be, that's your drive.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's a cognitive piece, which are your values and cultural beliefs. And then there's motivation. Motivation reflects all of the interpersonal and psychological aspects that sort of bring a woman to want to be sexual with or without much drive. So when a woman walks into my door or into her healthcare professional's door and says, I don't have interest or I've lost my desire, it's very important to think about whether this is about sort of your basic biologic hunger or whether there's something going on in your life that's draining your interest in being sexual with a given partner.
That's a very important distinction and one that will have to be teased out. And if women have an opportunity to be aware that there are these different parts, they don't have to think of it as one thing. It's actually one feeling, but derived from 3 different parts.
Yes, and that will very much help you and your clinician determine which treatment path to go. Because, if it's a drive issue, then you look at what's your health status, what medicines are you on, what else could be going on physiologically.
Menopause.
Right. Menopause, certainly. We know that 50% of testosterone, which is important for drive, is produced in the ovaries. So as your ovaries are shutting down, which is often long before 50, by the way, that you're starting
mm-hmm.
to notice this, unless you have a surgical menopause. So that certainly can impact your drive. So that's the biologic piece. Then the cognitive piece and the motivation piece could be about your relationship, and you can have all the drive in the world, but if you're not really happy in your relationship, no amount of testosterone, for example, is going to bring that back. So you need to think about what's biologic and what's psychologic. And everybody would like a simple fix in a pill, honestly, but not everything is that quick a fix. And you need to tease out the fact that desire is complicated. But not overwhelmingly so.
Mm-hmm. It's complex.
Yes, it is. We are complex, and sexuality is a little complicated, but that's what makes it interesting.
Absolutely.
So that's the first sexual disorder, and again, the most prevalent. About 10%. About 10% of women have low desire.
Ones that have some difficulty, desire constitutes 10% of the total of that of those women.
Thank you for doing the math for me. Yes,
okay.
That's exactly right. So that would be the most prevalent. Then sexual arousal disorder, which is essentially when you have desire, but either subjectively you're not aware, you can't perceive that your body is responding, or objectively your body really isn't lubricating and there isn't the vaginal swelling that we typically expect once you have desire. So it is a little different in that it tends to be a little bit more physiological. Logic, but in order to have arousal problems, you need to first have desire, but then the arousal doesn't work.
So you want to, but things aren't seeming to crank up a little for you.
Yes. And again, you brought up menopause. That is often a time when arousal is more difficult or slower. So many menopausal women who used to expect that, you know, they'd have desire and then their body would respond within seconds, now it's going to take a few minutes. And they need to be aware of that and sort of plan accordingly. Because if you try to, for example, have penetration before your body's lubricated and there's, you know, blood flow to the vagina, that could cause some difficulties and problems and discomfort.
So what happens here is that with a little education and reevaluation, someone, for instance, in menopause, but it could be for other reasons as well, who, given enough time, actually will overcome this inability to get aroused.
Yes, absolutely. So this is not a deal breaker. This is knowing your body and managing it accordingly.
Mm-hmm. That's very important.
It also, there can be some fringe benefits in that it sort of forces couples to slow down and take their time and engage in a little bit more caressing and sensual foreplay, and that's got to be good.
Absolutely. And what percentage of the time is this constitute a problem?
This is about 5%.
Mm-hmm.
So about 5% of women have arousal problems.
So probably a lot of the women that are initially bothered by that probably eventually figure out, hey, if I just take my time or if I can get him to take his time, this thing will all work its way out.
Yes, that's very much true.
Great.
Then the third problem is actually more of a phobia than anything, but it's called sexual aversion disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And I bring it up because it's a little different in that it may look like low desire, but in fact, this really is about almost a phobic avoidance of sexual activity. So a panic, fear, or even revulsion to the idea of being sexual. And this is a much lower prevalent problem. But it does exist, and so for women who are sort of confused by it, they need to know that women with low desire want sex, and women with aversion disorder may actually have plenty of drive, but the idea of being sexual creates panic and avoidance.
Would that be someone maybe who'd been sexually assaulted in the past or something like that?
It definitely could be. That is certainly a predictor of sexual aversion disorder, but sometimes it even happens spontaneously, just like other phobias occur sometimes without any sort of precipitating factors. So
uh-huh.
It can go either way.
Because
I
was struck, recently, last month, the Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology put forth a discussion about female sexual assault and pointing out that one in three women is sexually assaulted in her lifetime, which is astoundingly terrible information. But nonetheless, I would think with that level of history in the background that it would contribute at some point potentially in some of these arenas.
Yes, and some they do, but just think about the numbers, though. What you've just said is, between 1 in 3 and 1 in 4 women at some point in their life will be sexually assaulted, but it is not 1 in 3 and 1 in 4 that have a sexual dysfunction.
Right.
So most women, despite having been, assaulted, will do fine with their sexual function.
That's great.
So I think that's...
That's very encouraging. I mean, it's a terrible thing, but it's good for people to know that it's not the end of intimacy and it's not the end of the opportunity for closeness and for a normal sexual experience just because of that bad thing.
That's absolutely true. You are not stuck in the past.
Great. Well, that's wonderful.
So Then we have, I gave you a hypoactive sexual desire disorder, arousal disorder, aversion disorder, and then female orgasmic disorder, or anorgasmia. You can call it either one. And that's obviously the difficulty to in achieving orgasm. Either it is what we call primary or lifelong, in that women have never ever had an orgasm, or we call it secondary or acquired, meaning that at some point women were able to reach orgasm, but now they cannot, or if they can, it's with great difficulty. Mm-hmm. And once again, you know, you think about menopause as a culprit for that. For many women, you know, the loss of genital sensitivity with loss of estrogen can certainly can contribute to that. But it is, again, fairly prevalent. About just under 5% of women with sexual problems will have anorgasmia.
And do you think, as a result of less women taking estrogen, you know, after the Women's Health Initiative, we're about 10 years away from that experience, do you think that that is a major culprit, or do you think that the high prevalence of women, and men for that matter, but women who are taking, for instance, antidepressants and other medications, you think that's a medication-driven situation?
Well, Mesh, I would say yes, and yes, and yes. I think that the Women's Health Initiative and the fear of taking estrogens has been a problem, in that women have confused the idea that all estrogens are alike, and they're forgetting the fact that they can and many probably should be on a local estrogen or a topical, so that inserted vaginally, mm-hmm. because you know, at some point, even if not at the moment of menopause, but, you know, 5, 6, 7 years later, you know, vulvovaginal atrophy is sort of, you know, going to be a consequence of, you know, a woman without estrogen.
Yeah, so, it's shocking, you know, that I know at the last North American Menopause Society meeting, they had a whole seminar on this, and, you know, something like 85% of women will eventually have the potential for that anyway. It's to some degree, it's a huge problem with aging.
It is a huge problem, and women have been so frightened by the idea of systemic hormones, which, number one, we already know has, you know, has changed. The data really aren't as they first came out in 2002, but also you know, people don't pay attention to the fact that local estrogens can be a nice option for women. You know, mm-hmm. certainly the NAMS itself, North American Menopause Society, has its position statement with, you know, first line treatment should be lubricants and then long acting moisturizers. But for women whose symptoms are not resolved by that, a local estrogen really is a very nice option. And you need to talk to your healthcare professional about it.
Right.
But I think it's very important for women who have arousal disorder and pain with sexual intercourse and difficulty with orgasm. Those are all things that the first thing a menopausal woman should do is consider checking for vulvovaginal atrophy.
So lack of orgasm or anorgasmia is one of the categories, and then painful intercourse, which we kind of merged a little bit because of my questions, kind of caused you to blur a little. In just point out that you separate them, and they're actually two different
yes,
things.
Yes, I. Well, I had only given you 4 of my 6
categories
of sexual
stay
disorders.
Stay tuned.
And
now,
the last two are dyspareunia and vaginismus. And dyspareunia, uh-huh. Which, you know, we're redoing the diagnostic categories for future reference. But so dyspareunia probably will go away as a label.
Uh-huh.
But right now, what it really reflects is pain with penetration.
Mm-hmm.
So it is pain with any kind of sexual penetration. And oftentimes, it is really a symptom more than a diagnosis, because, you know, pain would be caused by many things.
Right.
Some women will have pain at the entrance of their vagina that could be due to vulvar vaginal atrophy, or could be due to other skin conditions, or some women would have deeper pain that could be caused by pelvic adhesions or endometriosis. So we
they
really
can have,
look at it as a symptom.
So they could have an outer, the lips of the outer lips of the vaginal area, and the tissues around that could be very thin, because of a lack of estrogen, and the inner part could also have some of that, but also there could be scarring inside or some other kinds of tissue deposits that could cause pain when you hit it and cause painful intercourse.
Absolutely. And so, you know, the message here is pain is, you know, it certainly interferes with sex, but the key to why it's a sexual dysfunction, really, the question should be, is the sex painful or is the pain sexual? And, you know, virtually all the time, it's that the sex is painful. And so we look at the underlying symptom and look at what's causing the symptom of pain and treat that. Don't treat it as, oh, you know, it's all in our head, because really we want to see what's causing the pain and address that.
I want to remind everyone that I'm talking with Dr. Cheryl Kingsburg, and she's the chief of the Division of Behavioral Medicine at University Hospitals at Case Medical Center, and professor in the departments of both reproductive biology and psychiatry at Case Western Reserve. And I'm your host, Dr. Mesh Seibel, and we're listening to Your Health Rocks on drseibel.com. So we're continuing our discussion. We've talked about the various categories of sexual dysfunction that affect women, and there are we got down to all but, I think, the last one.
Yes, and last but not least is vaginismus. And it's a mouthful, but vaginismus really reflects the inability to have penetration when it is wanted. Essentially, it's an anxiety disorder where the vaginal muscles tighten up in anticipation of pain with penetration, regardless of what the penetration is. And the reason it's a disorder is that it's wanted penetration. And this actually can extend to actually going to a pelvic exam. You know, there are some women who, when they get into the gynecologist's office, you know, their vagina, you know, essentially, if we're going to, you know, give voice to it, says, you're going to put what where? I don't think so. Let me protect you because it's going to hurt. And it tightens up.
This was the original vagina monologue?
Yes, it was the original vagina monologue.
Okay.
So it essentially has its own voice to protect its owner,
sure,
from anticipated pain. So treatment really is a cognitive behavioral perspective of using graduated dilators and desensitization and anxiety modification to allow for the awareness that penetration does not need to be painful.
So what it is just to restate that a little bit, is that your body, in this case the vagina, is basically anticipating a big pain, and it's basically saying no, and it's kind of rejecting the notion. So it's kind of closing up a little bit. All those muscles are squeezing close so that the pain that's anticipated won't happen. And the way to go about that is with a very programmatic kind of an approach where you can use very small things to insert that they're gradually getting bigger. And then when we talk bigger, we're talking about maybe the size of a little finger all the way up to the size of a thumb or thereabouts in terms of size. And we're talking about using approaches that are very gradual so that anxiety, etc., is overcome. Because in reality, if the muscles relaxed, the person would not experience one of the painful situations that we talked about earlier, such as the dyspareunia, that's that definition that's going to go away, the painful intercourse. It's not that the intercourse isn't painful. It's what's happening is there's a rejection of the notion because of a fear of pain.
That's it. You've got it.
Awesome. So when you come into a doctor, I mean, you know, today, the average visit is 8 minutes, let's face it. I mean, there ain't a lot of time with the doctor. You've got a woman that's going to come in now, and I always know when there's a problem with sexual dysfunction, at least some of them, because the husband's always there. You know, when the guy comes with the woman, it's only a few things it can be. But that aside, in the limited time of an exam, you have a situation where a woman is, you know, either embarrassed, she's frightened, she's unsure, she doesn't know if she has the right to say anything about this because, you know, it's not a disease, where in fact, you've already told us that it may or may not be a disease, but it's certainly a medical condition that is understood to require and demand treatment. So how does a woman go about this? I mean, you have a problem, you think you got a problem, things aren't working out. How do you approach your healthcare provider? Who do you see? Who are you going to call?
Well, first of all, I honestly, I'm loath to say anything because I think it's the healthcare professional's responsibility to bring it up. And I, you know, I'm spending my a good chunk of my career trying to educate physicians, nurse practitioners, anybody who will listen, that they need to be asking about sexual health of their patients because it shouldn't be a woman's responsibility.
I agree with you completely, but given
yes,
the
however,
fact, yes, the however part.
Given that that's, you know, I can't get to everybody, I want the women, the patient, to know that it is her perfect right to bring it up and that there are some easy ways to do that. Just like I teach clinicians some easy ways to approach the subject, I would say to the clinician, I'm having some sexual concerns. Is this an okay place to talk about it? If he or she, either going to say, great, I'm glad you brought it up. I was just about to. Or they will say, you know, it's not my area of specialty and let me refer you on. At least the door is open.
Could I say that there's a possible third option, if I might? And that is, a lot of times I find that when people are really, you know, really wired about something, they don't tell you anything until you're about out of time. And I'm not talking about a 10-minute appointment because I give patients a lot of time. But if, you know, you've been in there for 30 minutes or 25 minutes or 35 minutes, and now they want to say something. So one possibility is, you know, that's really important. But if we don't have time today, let's make an appointment to come back. In other words, if the person is willing, but this is a new occurrence, it may not come up, and you have an option if that person is okay with it, I think, to just say, come back when there's time and we'll really explore it. Because it's usually an out-the-door time, when, at least
sure,
in my experience.
Absolutely. But that's still the, you know, I'm glad you brought it up. And then you can either do a two-minute sexual history if you only have 2 minutes, or you can absolutely bring them back. And believe me, patients will want to come if it's important enough. It shows that the clinician respects the topic enough to bring them back for a special visit. And if they're not comfortable with the topic, then that's the time they will refer them on.
Absolutely.
But, you know, many clinicians, and I think patients also are worried about that, you know, Pandora's box. And if you open the door, what's going to come out? And honestly, patients are very good about being able to give a history with an open-ended question. And I always tell clinicians to say, you know, what sexual concerns do you have? And within less than 90 seconds, so in your 8-minute visit, you can do it in less than 90 seconds, you can get a clear history of what's going on, which gives the healthcare professional a good amount of information to decide, can I address the, we follow what we call the Plissett model.
Mm-hmm.
Is the simplest thing for a clinician to do is at least give the patient permission to talk about their sexual concerns and permission to have whatever way of thinking about their sexual lives that they want, so some permission giving. And then if they have a moment or two, they can give some limited information, some basic education, some referral to some reading, some, you know, a referral to another person. They can give some simple suggestions, so I'm getting to Plissett, some simple suggestions like some change in sexual repertoire or some maybe a medication issue, some sex therapy, basic sex therapy techniques, and then intensive therapy. So at any point that the topic is very complicated, at that point, usually your primary care doc or your gynecologist will refer you on to somebody else to say, this really is an important topic and needs to be treated appropriately. Let me send you to a specialist, and that would be the intensive therapy. So the Plissett model says to the patient, look, at whatever level you're at, your healthcare professional can address at least some of your concerns and help you get the help you need if they can't address them all.
So Plissett is a mnemonic, right?
Yes.
And
permission
so,
giving, limited information, specific suggestions, intensive treatment. I teach the medical students that all the time, and hopefully they're bringing it back to their patients.
I think that's awesome. And if nothing else, what happens with this is it puts a framework around something that happens so commonly. 50%, half the women are going to have a problem at some point in time. 10% are dealing with a significant problem. And here's a framework of conditions. And you have the right, in this case, not to remain silent. You have the right to speak up and to say that there's something going on and get the ball rolling. Get this out in the open.
Yes, if nothing else, feel free to talk about it. You know, baby boomers have come to midlife and are passing quickly through it, and they've never quietly sat through anything and taken, you know, no for an answer. So I don't want them to stop now.
Absolutely. Well, is it possible we could touch just a little bit on some of the treatments that are out there for some of these things? I mean, I would say that the idea of providing education is like number one. So, I mean, you're just amazingly full of information, and thank you so much for sharing it. And what are some of the things that a person might expect?
Well, again, thinking about, remember how I defined desire for you as having the psychological components, but also the biologic components.
Mm-hmm.
Based on whichever, you know, concerns you have, a clinician would determine how much does this seem to be biologically based and how much psychologically based. If it's psychological, then a little bit of counseling goes a long way, either individual or couples therapy, depending on what the problem is. And sex therapy, which kind of scares people thinking, what happens in sex therapy? Is that, you know, do you have to take your clothes off? What goes on? Really, it is generally a psychotherapy, cognitive behavior psychotherapy, where you look at the underlying beliefs and behaviors, clothes on, and with homework assignments, trying to alter negative beliefs and unhelpful behaviors that have gotten in the way.
I'm just going to say that just for clarification, and you did it right there at the end, but your focus in your chief of a division of behavioral medicine, and what you're saying is that you're teaching people to modify their behavior, their attitudes, their responses, their understandings, their interactions. I mean, it's a behavioral thing, just like many other kinds of physical conditions that one goes through. And that's what you're talking about with cognitive stuff.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And many things can be improved with changing, you know, perspective and beliefs and behaviors that, you know, we assume can't be fixed, but many things can. But there are other things that really may have a biologic underpinning. And right now, I have to say that except for topical estrogens for vulvovaginal atrophy and dyspareunia, there are no FDA-approved drugs for the other female sexual disorders. There is nothing on the market. We use testosterone. You had brought up testosterone before. We use testosterone off-label, meaning it's not for an indicated use, but clinicians often will use testosterone for postmenopausal women with hypoactive sexual desire disorder if they've ruled out some of the you know, interpersonal and psychological components. They can empirically try testosterone in some of these women to see if it will work. There are some interesting investigational drugs that are in phase 2 and phase 3 trials, looking at, you know, big clinical trials to see if they are safe and if they work, which I think show a lot of promise. There are some non-hormonal options, for example, a drug called bremelanotide works on melanocortins in the brain, which are, you know, so anyway, it's a direct stimulation to the brain center that affects desire.
Mm-hmm.
There's flibanserin, which is essentially a drug like a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, similar to the antidepressants.
That's like Effexor and Prozac and those medications.
Yes, although it happens to not work as an antidepressant, but works to improve sexual desire.
Mm-hmm.
Biosante has Libigel, which is a testosterone gel that is in phase 3 trials, looking to see whether it works for hypoactive sexual desire disorder. And there are a few others that are on the horizon. So, there's nothing yet for women. We have lagged way behind men in terms of clinical research and getting anything approved. But I haven't given up, and I'm hoping that women will have many more options in the years to come.
Do you think these are like 3 years away, 5 years away, or you think they're way downstream?
I don't think it's way downstream, but I'm always hopeful that in the next couple of years we would see something happen.
This is important to me to underscore because, a lot of times when women go in to maybe they go to their primary care doctor, maybe they go to their GYN doctor, they go wherever, and they have a lot of symptoms related to menopause. For instance, they may have a hot flashes, they may have palpitations, they may have this, may have that. Whatever they have, they end up getting, for instance, an antidepressant. Many times women will get that. And so they're in those pills sometimes end up having a negative impact on sexual function. But the point I was trying to make is that here we don't have a pill to just hand off. Here, take these pills. So it revolves around the importance of disclosure or on the part of the woman or getting a good history on the part of the clinician and however it takes. And then using these behavioral techniques to overcome it, because there ain't no pill. We got to talk our way through this thing, and then we can work it out.
Mm-hmm. I think that's tremendous advice. I think we don't want to rely too much on a pill, and it's very easy to do that. And sometimes it's a combination. But talking to your clinician about what you're taking is so helpful because, not only are the antidepressants particular culprits in causing sexual dysfunction, but some of the over-the-counter things that women don't even think to mention because there's no prescription can be causing some problems. So be sure to mention everything you're taking.
You're talking about things like maybe an antihistamine that could dry a person, or what are you
speaking about? Antihistamines or some of the, something like St. John's wort or, some of the herbal remedies that people are taking for things that they just don't think about. You had been talking about postmenopausal women, but, there's an awful lot of controversy about oral contraception and the impact on what's called sex hormone binding globulin and the fact that oral contraceptives used in young women for years can impact their desire.
Yeah, so basically the oral contraceptive increases this substance in the blood, this protein called sex hormone binding globulin, and guess what? Estrogen and testosterone are sex hormones. And so instead of being free to stimulate the person, they get sucked up into this sort of protein sponge and become inactive. And then younger women are becoming less sexually stimulated because they have less of their hormones because they're taking these oral contraceptives. So if a person were on an oral contraceptive for years and years, she might notice a change and not understand what's going on. It could be just that is what you're saying, I think.
That's exactly what I'm saying. Good thing you're here to interpret for me.
Well, you're doing amazing. I mean, it's just so much information. Let me just say this. If you have a problem, one of these many, what's the chance that you're going to get cured? You go in, you summon up all your courage, or the doctor catches you off guard and actually ask you this question that you really want to talk about, and now you're going to spill it all out. What's the chance you're going to, at some point, walk out of there, and maybe not that day, but at what point are we going to have a, what percentage of women can anticipate a good outcome for this, an improvement?
That's actually a very difficult question for a couple of reasons. One is, cure is a funny thing. I think that we all need to think about, just like I said, desire is complicated, cure as well. I think we need to think about what success would be. Mm-hmm. What would you personally feel like is necessary to change in order to feel like treatment was successful? Is that, you know, a change in genital blood flow? Is it a sense of satisfaction in your sexual life? So I think it's important not to have some sort of narrow range of what cure is, and to, because that, I think, sets people up to fail. And I think improvement in quality of life and overall satisfaction would be very helpful. And for that, I would say the majority of women can certainly have success, and certainly we can do a lot to improve their sexual lives. But for some women, honestly, until there are some pharmacologic options for those who have a biologic underpinning for their sexual dysfunction, there's not a lot I can do for everybody. It's not a one-size-fits-all. Not everybody needs a pharmacologic option, but some women absolutely do. And so I'm hoping for the day when there will be many options, many treatment options, so that the vast majority of women coming in, regardless of whether it's desire disorder, an orgasmic disorder, or vaginismus, can easily walk out knowing that they will be successful in their treatment.
So, you, like the Rolling Stones says, you can't always get what you want, but you get what you need.
If that leads you into a song, then absolutely. Much better than I can't get no satisfaction.
Yeah, that's touche. Very well done. Well, we have been talking with Cheryl Kingsburg. She is the Chief Division of Behavioral Medicine at the University Hospitals Case Medical Center, and she is a professor in the departments of both reproductive biology and psychiatry. She is a delightful person. She is one of the country's most knowledgeable people in this area, and it's a distinct pleasure to have a chance to talk with you about this. I want to thank you for spending some time with us.
Oh, well, thank you very much for having me. It was my pleasure.
I'm your host, Dr. Mesh Seibel. You're listening to Your Health Rocks, and you can hear similar types of information on drseibel.com. And remember, it's better to stay well than to get well. So stay well, everyone.